Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. Our topic on this edition of the program, an update on the political trajectories of Tunisia and Libya. Our guest, William Lawrence, visiting professor of political science and international relations at George Washington University's Elliott School. And William is also director for the Middle East and North Africa programs at the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy here in Washington. William Lawrence has 28 years of experience working in and on the Maghreb and has lived in the North African region for 12 years. From 2011 to 2013, William Lawrence directed the North Africa Project at the International Crisis Group, where he supervised research and engaged in advocacy on Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, Western Sahara, and Mauritania. He also assisted with Mali, the Sahel, and Egypt. And during this period, he briefed senior officials at the United Nations, the European Union, and over 200 other governmental and non-governmental organizations on developments and policy options in North Africa. We'll talk with William Lawrence on the one hand about the hopeful results and implications of the recent parliamentary and presidential elections in Tunisia. Nida Tunis, Tunisia's main secular party, emerged as the winner over the Islamist Ennahda Party, the leading force in post-revolution Tunisia. In presidential elections, Nida Tunis founder Beji Caid Sebsi defeated incumbent Moncef Marzouki. And on the other hand, we'll examine the continuing chaos engulfing Libya, where entrenched divisions, stalled negotiations, and two rival governments threaten the very existence of the Libyan state. And we're delighted to welcome William Lawrence back here at the studio. Bill Lawrence, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back.
Well, I know you're known as William, but we're going to call you Bill.
Okay.
Bill, let's start with the bad news story, one could say, Libya. There's just so much chaos going on. One can barely figure out, you know, who's up, who's down. There are two competing governments in Libya. There's the internationally recognized Libyan government based in Libya's eastern city of Tobruk, and then the rival administration supported by Islamist fighters, which now controls Tripoli and the port city of Misrata. What's going on?
Well, I think the simplest way to view it is we had a revolution and a civil war in 2011, and we had a new civil war that started in May 2014. What started the war was that a former Gaddafi general, Haftar, a longtime resident of Falls Church, Virginia, right near the studio here, announced in February 2014 on Valentine's Day that he was going to take things back into control. The war didn't actually start until May, but that's when he began attacking. What prompted this was a number of grievances, but mainly that there had been a long series of assassinations in Benghazi, both of civil society activists like Salwa Bugeges, which actually that was after the war started, and generals and policemen and others. And so they decided they would take things in their own hands and take the attack to the other side. What happened was is that disparate forces that hadn't really been working together unified when they started being attacked by Haftar, and they started winning the battles. Mm-hmm. So the Zintanis, who he was allied with, who'd controlled the Tripoli airport, left. Now that were beaten back, now the Tripoli airport's in ruins, you know. And all around Libya, forces that Haftar was going after began to work together. So militarily, his forces have lost control of much of the country, and this rump state in Tobruk controls maybe 10% of Libya, his side. On the other side of it, you've got the Misratans, you've got this former parliament reconstituted called the GNC, you've got various Islamists from the moderates all the way to the radical fighting with them, and they control the majority of Libya. So where things go really depends on a political deal between the two sides.
Exactly. This is not going to be won militarily. Therefore, we know that there are six Western powers that have welcomed the United Nations announcement of a new round of political dialogue on Libya this week. What are the chances of success?
Poor. And that's because both sides don't have a lot of good reasons to go and deal effectively towards peace. The rump government based in Tobruk believes it has to win this militarily. And they just need a lot of weapons and a lot of support from the West and from Egypt and UAE, and they'll win this thing. And they don't believe the other side is going to negotiate, because this is the Islamists who want to take Libya back to the Dark Ages, and they can't be spoken to. This is the way they look at it. The other side believes themselves, and this is very important, as representing the revolution. Most young Libyans are with the other side, right? They call themselves Thuwat, or revolutionaries. They believe they're defending the revolution against counter-revolutionary forces who have joined with Haftar. So part of his side is the old Gaddafi forces who are fighting with Haftar. So they believe they're defending the revolution, and it's become sort of a zero-sum game. The last 2-3 months, it's become very violent. And both sides feel not only that they can win it, they feel they have to win it, because the other side is evil, is supported by foreign forces that can't be trusted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So things don't look well for the Geneva negotiations starting out. There's also some criticism of the UN envoy, Leon, mm-hmm. who is a very good diplomat and a very sincere man, but he's been quite ineffective. And the Western powers, among others, have been pushing him to be more assertive in how he runs this process. He hasn't asserted himself in a way that helped the negotiations move forward.
There's certainly a lot at stake, not only for Libya and Libyans to get their act together to govern this oil-rich country with so many other human and natural resources, but for the region, because the fallout from this chaos is affecting many other nations, whether Mali, Chad, and so forth. To what extent do regional players, and you alluded to Egypt and the UAE, to what extent are they having an influence on this crisis, to the good or for the worse?
They're influencing it. They're hugely affected by it. Tunisia is rocked by things that are happening in Libya. Upwards of 1 million Libyans have moved to Tunisia, refugees and others. Algeria, the In Amenas attack was staged in Libya. The whole Malia conflict came from people coming from Libya. French defense minister was just in Chad. They're being, you know, hit hard by this. Niger. All the countries around want intervention. And the Sahelian countries south of Libya have actually called for international intervention, because it's just too much impact.
When you say international intervention, you mean some kind of blue helmets, UN peacekeepers?
That group or not. They want an international intervention, whether or not it's blue helmeted. Mm-hmm. And the issue there is, to really oversimplify, but it's true, when the U.S. talks Libya at the UN, the Russians start talking Ukraine. And so it would take probably substantial concessions on Ukraine in order to get a Security Council resolution on Libya. And then because of that, people start talking about a non-UN operation as being necessary.
Very interesting.
On the other side of it, you have, of course, Sisi and the UAE, who believe that the only way to deal with Islamists is the way that the rhetoric out of Tobruk says, by killing them. And people in Tobruk say, you know, how can you say negotiate with terrorists? You're not really negotiating with ISIS. The problem is that ISIS, which exists in Libya, probably represents less than 1% of the fighters. And the others have shown that they do negotiate. So this idea that somehow these are just nasty Islamists who can't be negotiated with is a bit of a construction.
Exactly. It's not monolithic,
No. The
group. I mean, you said
that they were forced together.
Exactly. They were forced together by the very people who say they should go down the drain. Well, that leads us to wonder, you know, is there any role for the United States and the European Union in preventing Libya from becoming a failed state?
Absolutely. Everyone keeps talking about a UN-led process, but I was just thinking this morning about my international relations classes in graduate school, where I learned that the UN was nothing without the actions of its members. And the most important member at the UN is the United States. And when it comes to UN action on Libya, it has to be the United States, for a lot of reasons that we've discussed in past programs, including that the Libyan oil industry prefers American technology and involvement in Libya. So many Libyans have studied the United States. There's more trust towards the United States than towards Europe and Libya. And so the U.S. really has to step up. And whether it's leading from behind, which actually isn't as bad a phrase as people often make it out to be, or even being more assertive, the U.S. is going to have to step up and mediate here.
So specifically, what should they be doing?
Well, there's a lot of various ideas. I know our ambassador, Deborah Jones, who I've discussed this with, is very, very active, and she meets with various Libyan groups all the time. The new president of Tunisia, Beji Caid Sepsi, who we'll be talking about in a minute, he has a weekly meeting on Libya with everyone he can find. He's very active. The Tunisians are very active, including the Islamist leader, Sheikh Yanush, who is willing to play a role in mediation. He has a good reputation in Tripoli, so it could be helpful. So, I mean, there are a lot of countries, the French, others. Who are willing to play a role here, but no one's found the silver bullet. And there's a big debate going on in Washington, Brussels, New York, Paris, and other capitals right now about whether you can bring the Libyan factions to the table more through sticks, i.e. sanctions and other things, or more through carrots. I'm an advocate for more carrots. I don't think that we've been that strong and that effective with issuing sanctions on Libyans. But the fighters on both sides have shown they're willing to fight without money and without international support if they have to. And so more international approbation, I think, will have the opposite of the desired effect.
Ultimately, what type of government do you think Libya is able to sustain?
Well, the parameters of a future Libyan state made a lot of sense, but that's not really on people's minds right now because Libya's on the verge of either falling apart into regions, separate countries, or a sustained conflict like Lebanon or Algeria that could go on for 10 or 20 years. And that's where the stakes are so high right now. So people aren't really talking about forms of government much these days the way they were in the last couple of years. But the parameters of a Libya state that holds together and works are clear. It's going to have to be a federal system with a devolution of powers out to the regions that had always been underserved both by Tripoli under Gaddafi and Tripoli under previous rulers. And throughout the longer stretch of Libyan history, it will have to be more respectful of minorities like the Amazigh and the Tabu and the Tuareg. It's going to have to be probably more Islamic than what we're seeing in Tunisia and some of the other countries. Libyans are in agreement that Sharia has to be the basis of the constitution. So what that does is that launches a debate on what does Sharia mean in the 21st century? Which parts of Islam are we going to emphasize in this new state in terms of human rights and rights of women and that sort of thing? And that's a debate that Libyans want to have, but it's very hard to have in the middle of a war. In the midst of all this, it's very interesting. The Constitutional Committee continues to meet in Beida. And there's a draft of the Libyan constitution out. So, you know, there is some progress there. And it'll be interesting to see going forward if the constitutional debate itself becomes sort of a nucleus around which the two sides can begin to have a conversation or whether it just becomes sort of an irrelevancy in this long war that may be starting now ignores what happened with the constitution.
Well, we'll have to continue to follow events in Libya and hope that they will turn around for the best. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is William Lawrence. He's a visiting professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University here in Washington. He's also director for Middle East and North Africa programs at the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook via Carol Castiel VOA. Or you can send feedback via good old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Here's a shout-out to a faithful listener from Brazil, Marcos Paulo. Obrigado, Marcos. If you want to hear your name on the show and get a shout-out in your native language, send me an email or like us on Facebook. Well, back to you, William Lawrence, and let's turn now to hopefully a more positive story, and that's Tunisia. And, of course, we acknowledge the free and relatively fair elections that recently took place, both parliamentary and presidential, that brought President Caid Sepsi to power. He won over his rival, of course, Moncef Marzouki. Why do you think he won?
Well, Beji Caid Sepsi's been in politics since the 50s, since before independence. And so he's seen the entire trajectory of Tunisian history, pre-independence and post-independence in 1956. And that's why he won, because Tunisians wanted to go back to a Tunisia that was safe and economically solvent and protecting what's important about Tunisia for Tunisians, which is a certain amount of freedoms, a certain amount of rule of law, et cetera, et cetera. It was a reaction against the failure of the Troika governments, the Nehadelet government and its partners, who were beaten up a bit in the polls because of their inability to deal with the crises began by the revolution itself. And these include an economic crisis, which Tunisia has entered into, a security crisis, and other post-revolutionary issues that are very, very difficult to deal with.
On the other hand, what did he say, or what do you think he can do, him and the Nida Tunis party, that can address the concerns of Tunisians, insofar as, if I'm not mistaken, the bulk of the people that voted for him were not the so-called revolutionaries, per se, yeah. And he won with votes from the more affluent people who live on the coast and older voters. He himself is 88 years old. Again, not discriminating against age, but still, he does represent an older generation. What can he bring to the table? How can he create jobs, address the economic malaise, and also, of course, the security situation?
Well, he has a couple of aces in his pocket, I guess. One is that he knows the Tunisian government. He was the interim prime minister right after the revolution and has long experience in the government. He definitely has a good relationship with the business class in Tunisia, who are going to be the engine of job creation. He will have to make it to 93 to complete his term, but I don't think people who were voting for Béchir Kaïd Sebsi were voting for him for what he was. They were voting for him more for what he was not. And it was interesting with Marzouki in the presidential campaign, a lot of people voted for Marzouki. He got a much better score than people expected him to. Also, because once Nida Tunis won the parliamentary election, a lot of Tunisians said in post-election polls they wanted balance, and they had voted for Nida Tunis to balance against Nehda. Then they realized that Nida Tunis was about to run the tables and control what the Tunisians call the three presidencies, presidency of the parliament, the presidency of the government, and the presidency of the nation. And then, so there was a bit of a backlash, not enough to elect Marzouki, but to make it a closer race than people expected, because Tunisians want balance.
Now, remind us who Marzouki is. That is, what does he represent? What political party?
Yeah.
He's not Ennahda.
Yeah, he was the head of the party that was one of the coalition partners of Nehda. He was president of Tunisia until just the end of December. He was from the CPR party, which is a secular, left-leaning, human rights-oriented party that was beaten up in the legislative elections in October and have more than just a couple of seats in parliament.
Now, we note that President Sebsi selected Habib Essid. He's a former veteran of the Ben Ali regime and the transitional minister of the interior. He's the new prime minister. So he's not from the Nida Tunis party. What does that selection suggest?
I think when I think about Nehda, I think they're often a little bit too focused on integrity and not on competence. And I think when I think of Nida Tunis and that crowd, they're a little focused on competence and not always on the politics that'll make things work. And whatever we see from Nida Tunis, we're going to see to some degree a government of technocrats, because there's this belief that you can do the hard things and do what everyone agrees on by bringing in technocrats. The problem is that's not a very sort of democratic way of doing things. And so it remains to be seen, you know, to what degree this technocrat that they want to bring in, a longtime government official, you know, whether he'll be able to address Tunisia's big problems. Tunisia's biggest problem, other than the security issue, is a fiscal crisis. So I'm not so sure that the technocrats and the competencies are enough. You also need politics. You need to get the population of Tunisia with you. And to do that, there's probably need to be an alliance in parliament, if not a coalition, that represents a lot of the seats and a lot of the political parties. As we saw, the constitution was passed by 96% of the members of parliament, over 20 political parties. You're going to have that kind of support to get the bitter economic pills Tunisians are going to have to swallow accepted by the population.
One more question with respect to the prime minister. Sebsi did say that he was going to exclude former regime officials in his new government. So now with this nomination of the prime minister, he has broken that promise.
True. And I think this is a very, very important thing. Perhaps as much as anything else, what prompted the Libya crisis next door, which led to the resignation of their last sort of prime minister that had much gravitas, was the exclusion law that excluded former regime officials from serving. And that precipitated this degradation of politics and this falling apart in Libya. The same law was being proposed in Tunisia. And in a dramatic moment a year ago, Rashid Ghannouchi, who isn't even a member of parliament, went down to the parliamentary floor and convinced a number of parliamentarians not to vote for a similar exclusion law in Tunisia because it could do the very type of political derailing that was happening in Libya. And so Assid and Bejiqad Sebsi in some ways owe their jobs to the enlightened position that Nahda took on the political exclusion law. And so all of this is very interesting. It'll be interesting to see how many of these many former regime officials who are, getting back to my previous point, seen as the most competent Tunisians, allowed back in to either be competent and perhaps politically unpopular, or do you want to bring in people who are less competent, less experienced, but have more support of the population? It's a very delicate balance right now in Tunisia.
That's a very interesting point. Now, the rival Islamist party, Nahda, has reportedly said it will take part in the Essid government. How important is that development to the potential success of Tunisia's transition?
Critical. There are a lot of independent analysts of Tunisia who almost to a person agree that a national unity government is the best way to go. The problem is that Nida Tunis ran on a platform of we're not Nahda and they'll take you back to the dark ages. So to then go into an alliance with them is going to alienate a lot of their rank and file, both from the left and from the right, and the leftist parties that would have been in a coalition with them if they didn't team up with the Nahda. So it's a very complicated calculus. But you can't do the big things. You can't deal with these huge security issues without Nahda on board. You can't deal with these huge economic issues easily without Nahda on board.
The Obama administration is inviting the Tunisian president to Washington. How important a signal is that in your view?
Very, very important. Tunisia needs big assistance. By some estimates, it needs probably $5 billion of assistance over the next 5 years. And we're still talking sort of assistance in the hundreds of millions. It's been very weak. And this is the only true Arab democracy right now, which is also sending a lot of fighters to Iraq and Syria. If Tunisia doesn't succeed in terms of its democracy, and don't get me wrong, there were more candidates for the Tunisian parliament than fighters that have gone to Iraq and Syria, 9,000 versus 3,000.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. You know, so it's not that Tunisians aren't enthused about democracy, of course, but you need democracy to succeed in Tunisia, not just for Tunisian reasons, but for regional reasons. It helps Libya. It helps maybe Egypt get back on track. And so Tunisians need big help on security. They need direct budget support. They need a package from the World Bank and the IMF and other economic stimuluses. They need support on justice and transitional justice. They need the whole package.
What about the new Republican Congress? Will they see it that way and put their money where their mouth is?
Well, my organization's been working closely. In fact, we were supposed to have a meeting today with the head of the Tunisia Caucus, which is a newly active group on the Hill. But so far, congressmen on an individual basis seem to get the Tunisia story, but I certainly haven't seen much momentum yet on Tunisia from the Republican Congress. We've actually been working on a new resolution on Tunisia that should be out in the coming days or weeks from Congress, congratulating Tunisia and sort of signaling an interest in deepening and broadening U.S. assistance to Tunisia.
You would think that just to counter ISIS, this so-called Islamic State, and other failures as a result of the Arab Spring, whether Libya, Syria, obviously, that they would invest as much as possible in Tunisia to create a model. But with respect to so many Tunisians going off to Syria and Iraq, how do you explain that, William Lawrence? Why are so many joining the so-called Islamic State?
There are many reasons for this. And if you look at the biographies of individuals fighting in Syria and Iraq, you know, you have as much diversity of reasons as you have people there. It's very complicated. And why somebody goes from Birmingham, UK, or France, or Arizona, or Morocco, you know, it's a very complicated picture. You have fighters from, I think, over 80 countries now with ISIS governing an area of 8 million people in Iraq and Syria. It's complicated, but I think why so many from Tunisia? I think there are two reasons in particular. Number one, Tunisians had a revolution, are free to travel, where a lot of them went originally to fight Assad, and they feel inspired to help Syrians experience what they experienced in Tunisia. They're not against necessarily the Tunisian revolution. They want to go liberate Syria. That's the way they view it. Second, Tunisians are very well off. And so the Tunisian middle class is much bigger than other Arab countries. So families and individuals tend to have the resources to get to Turkey or wherever they need to do, or through Libya to wherever, to get over to fight the jihad. Now, when they get there, things can go south. Now hundreds of Tunisians have returned dismayed by what they encountered in Syria. There was one very well-known case covered by BBC of a e-jihadist in a wheelchair that went over, and he thought he was going to be fighting the electronic jihad. And when he got there, they told him he was going to be a suicide bomber as a man in a wheelchair. So his family went and rescued him from Syria and brought him back, and this got a lot of press play in Tunisia. But these are the stories right now. And that said, this e-jihadist is still angry and would like to fight the jihad on something. He just doesn't want to do it in Syria. So there's a lot of young, angry people who believe that through Islam, they can get the kind of integrity, purity, good governance that the world needs to be a better place. The problem is they don't always know what they're getting into.
They don't know what they're getting into. And so a lot of them are affiliating themselves with a so-called Islamic State.
Yeah.
But what they really are saying, they're against Assad in the crackdown that he did on his own people.
A lot of the people who went for that reason.
Right. And so
Assad.
We need to rectify that situation if we want to slow the flow of foreign fighters to Syria.
Yeah.
Well, lastly, one more thing before I let you go. What can other Arab Spring nations like Egypt or Libya or, Yemen even, we see it's also in chaos and crisis, learn from the Tunisian experience?
There are many things they can learn, but it's really about dialogue, consensus, confidence building. Politics should not be seen as a zero-sum game. Most political actors act out of fear and fear-mongering, and they're not always willing to deal with the other side on its own terms and to, as you learn in negotiation theory, for example, think about the other side winning along with your win. That's how you get to deals. That's how you get to yes. And that's not a traditional part, let's say, of Arab politics. Arabs make deals, right? But it's often making peace in a conflictual situation without necessarily furthering the relationship in a way that's mutually beneficial. Libya's going to be a conservative society, however much the seculars want it to be something else. And it's going to have a lot of not very religious people, however much the Islamists would like it to be otherwise. Learning to respect others' difference for their differences of opinion and live with them, this is a lesson we all need to learn better. And it's something that's relatively new to the Arab world. And with the Arab Spring exposed a lot of fault lines. And now there needs to be a lot of community building across these lines.
Well, let's hope that Tunisia can serve as this very important and enlightening model for the region. William Lawrence is a visiting professor of political science and international relations at George Washington University's Elliott School. He's also director for Middle East and North Africa programs at the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. As always, William Lawrence, thank you for coming in, sharing your wonderful insights.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Misha Dubinsky. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.